So welcome everyone. If you weren't here for the session before, welcome to the second Blockchain for Good Unconference. If you were here, welcome to just the second session. My name is Nathalie Panetier. I'm just going to be launching that conversation, but we've got amazing guests who will be continuing the conversation, and you all will be doing the rest. So I'm just going to be setting the scene. Before we dive into that conversation, I'd like to say a couple of words about the Blockchain for Good Association and about the format we're going to be following. So Blockchain for Good is a collective of academics, civil society entrepreneurs who have been interested since 2018 in topics at the intersection of blockchain and sustainable development goals, so the SDGs. We mainly have three mains of actions: data of global scope that we collect, report through published analysis, and events that we organize for the community to meet. So firstly, we collect data about impact projects that are built on public blockchain globally, and we release them as an open data set. Beyond the open data set, we write acculturation reports by sector of activity that are understandable by anyone and that are published under Creative Commons license. We also organize events like this one or smaller meetups to build bridge really between the for good ecosystem, whether interested in blockchain or not. So today we have the opportunity to discuss four themes. You're here for the second theme of the day, where we will discuss food, water, energy, and supply chain. And this afternoon, stay if you're interested in the topics of climate and environment and peer-to-peer money for good, as there will be the conversations happening after the lunch break. The association and the Blockchain for Good Unconference we're all here for today would not have been possible without the academic, financial and human support of the Institut Louis Bachelier, Blockchain at Polytechnique, Group Caisse des Dépôts, BPI France and Crédit Agricole Corporate Investment Bank, so we thank them all for giving us the opportunity to conduct research on all the topics that I've mentioned. So now, the conversation we're going to have and how it will unfold. So the conversation is being recorded to be broadcast as a podcast later. So you may see cameras around us, but don't worry, there's no image being recorded, just sound. So I'm not going to steal Jacques-André's joke, or maybe I will. If you do not want to be registered, don't speak. I'll start by introducing the context of the conversation. It's going to be quite short, for 10 minutes, no more, maybe less. In this format, we don't have panelists and an audience. We have guests and special guests, so I'll introduce you to the special guests, and I will give them the floor after my introduction with just one question, and then that should spark the conversation that we have. We have around 50 minutes to an hour of conversations. The rules of the game, so everything goes smoothly, is only speak to a microphone for the recording, for the benefit of the recording. Don't hog the microphone, because we all want to kind of chat between us. When you speak, give your name, and the first time you speak, also the name of your organization before asking the question. And then enjoy the unconference format. It's going to evolve into a conversation. We've seen this. We see it all the time. And let's make the most of it, of this to learn from one another. So now let's get into our topic of today: food, water, energy, supply chain. We all know in this room that the global food system is broken. Agriculture and farming is facing numerous challenges, including climate change, resource depletion, and market volatility. Supply chains are long, they're fragile, they're very untransparent, inefficient, So we know we have a problem. We are all in this room interested or intrigued by blockchain solutions. We know and we've heard of new ways to track merchandise, to fund farmers, to tokenize assets. We can all think of many innovative and really neat projects that are being tested around the world that are rather exciting, I have to say. The question we really want to dive in today that I'm throwing here in the middle is decentralization really a cure to our issues or is it just a patch? Can we really build a new system out of all of this? So can decentralization really help? How systemic can we go? We will be talking probably about real world asset. We will be talking about digital monitoring, reporting and verification. We will be talking about network effects. Let's try, this is like the pledge, to not use acronym in our conversation, but first explain what they stand for. And we'll try to go systemic nonetheless. So if we think first about, you know, food production, of all the world's food, 80% is produced today by family farms. But to be really precise, that in terms of size of the farms, smallholder produce a third of all of the world crops. For coffee, which some of our special guests will talk about, 80% of the coffee in the world is produced by 25 million farmers that are currently in state of poverty. These farmers lack access to capital. They lack access to capital to operate and to develop. They lack access to insurance. And in our current context of intensifying climate havoc, only 20% of smallholder farmers have agricultural insurance. So this means that 80% are vulnerable in precarious situation, and that represents $60 to $80 billion of agricultural insurance value coverage that is missing. So to talk about this with us and to talk about the access to funding and access to resource, we do have the privilege of having Yuri and Gabriela from Ethic Hub, who is... their mission is to connect smallholder farmers to finance to the financing they need, so they this and to act as a bridge with the farmers. Our system is unsustainable because the food producers themselves are not living and operating in sustainable conditions. So we, beyond the need for funding, also need to talk about the need to access to energy, and Shebnem from Udera will be talking about that with us. We also need to think about other types of resources, and we need to think about water. And today we live in a world where 2.2 billion people globally lack access to water. That's 1 in 10 people not having clean water source close to home. 3 in 10 schools globally without basic access to water. So there are solutions to access to water that are developing with blockchain-based systems, and Jean-Hugues from Lake that leverages blockchain technology to decentralize the access to the global water economy will be able to tell us more about this. The food is produced, we have water, we have resources. We do have an issue with supply chain next. 1/5 of the food produced for human consumption is wasted or lost globally. So in perspective, that means that 1 billion meals are being lost per day, according to the World Food Programme. This is a value loss of $1 trillion. This is the scale of the issue. And to add to the pain, it represents 10% of global greenhouse emissions. The longer and the more complex the supply chain is, the more loss it creates, the more difficult it is to trace good and transfer, and the more diluted the responsibility is. So this sounds like a massive opportunity for an overhaul. How can we ensure and certify that all of the actors in the chain take responsibility for the goods that they are transferring? Can tokens that certify the transfer of ownership, but also the transfer of responsibility, be the solution? And we can discuss this with Quentin from Honest, which does just that. We need to create new ways to have to do market, and we need to create new business model. And to get to the final consumers, maybe we need to reinvent the way we approach this and think about a hub between producers, lenders, and customers, like Ethic Hub can also talk to us about. And finally, do we need a new digital infrastructure altogether to build that new system? Impact tokenization is a very transversal matter, and we have the privilege of having shown from the OG, I would say, project IXO, the Internet of Impact, who can enlighten us on all of this. So maybe I've been longer than what I thought. I don't know, but I'm about to throw the first question, and I would like to ask from each of our special guests, in their area, they think blockchain-based solution can solve that no other means of approaching the issue has solved so far. And they can go in whichever way they want.
So solar is an inherently distributed business because you have it on rooftops. But nonetheless, big banks and big players thrive on big projects, so that means they put it on oceans, which then got devastated and so on, or on land that could be used for something else, really, really huge installations. Udera is one of those solar asset managers. They own and operate, originate solar rooftops, and they see themselves as a distributed energy provider because those commercial and industrial buildings, the clients, they have a business to run and they cannot become their own energy providers. So that's the solution to keep it as decentralized as possible. But nonetheless, the market forces favor centralization. For example, it's much easier to buy up all those small solar installers into a group to coordinate them under one CEO. Others do that as well. And Udera, or talk to banks. As big as you are, the easier it is to talk to banks. But Udera chooses the middle path of keeping it decentralized. And they have an issue that when they scale into Europe, they're starting in Switzerland, in Portugal, in Spain since 2-3 years, and I helped them come to Germany, and I experienced it myself. When they come into a new country, the knowledge credit score is zero. Talk to the banks from anew. So that's really interesting aspect of tokenization or having transactions publicly on chain where you can build a credit score. And a distributed energy supplier, again, with a distributed network of solar partners and a distributed incentive scheme for building owners who allow their clients, companies, to actually have access to clean electricity right from their rooftops. That's a lot of incentives to align, and that's difficult. Again, you can buy everything up, make it easy for you, make it easy for all of your investors, but that creates centralization. So I see blockchain, tokenization, decentralized finance as a very fine opportunity to keep an inherently decentralized business decentralized. And we can ask, what's the point of decentralization? But maybe I come to that later.
Yeah, so I'm going to give an answer which is less about the technology itself, but more about what the technology enables. And what I'm most excited about is that it can give people agency. And in particular, youth who can gain agency within the impact economy. So we're working with UNICEF and an ecosystem of other partners in something called the Youth Opportunities Marketplace. And this is mobilizing millions of youth to participate in green economy, circular economy, and to perform micro gigs. Now, this is obviously particularly focused on areas of the world, like across Africa and Southeast Asia, where there is a big young population, and there is not enough employers, And there are many hundreds of millions of youth who are disenfranchised and really don't have hope and don't have good schooling, haven't had good schooling, haven't had good opportunities. And so this provides youth with a way of showing up in the economy and participating and getting rewards and building up their digital credentials to create a digital CV. And it provides a connection between the people who want to see things happen, such as distributing green energy devices or sort of the cliched thing, planting trees, to fund that and to get it done in verifiable ways that are very, very scalable. And so from an infrastructure perspective, it's really about networks. You know, so we have this new infrastructure now, this digital infrastructure that enables us to scale devices, for instance. So for clean cook stoves or e-mobility vehicles or off-grid solar or whatever, to really scale that to create the aggregation which Shebnam spoke about, so that you can create utility-scale solutions but through decentralized networks. Now, in order to implement those networks, to support the households, to do the promotion, to provide customer support, etc., you need people. And so these networks of youth agents can be tasked and trained to do specific activities that that achieve this. And so you get a hyper-exponential scaling potential between scaling physical infrastructure and scaling human agent networks. And then the third thing which we're excited about bringing into the world is decentralized autonomous AI agents. So if you're a youth agent who doesn't have the skills or knowledge about how to do the task, you can now be supported in the task. If a device such as a cook stove needs to be fixed, it can be it can actually request a youth agent to come and fix it with these capabilities. So this is the sort of next phase of what we're doing, and this enables us to get to the scale of millions that's needed in a short time frame, which otherwise is not possible unless you create the you know, the Chinese government, and you create the a massive army and a top-down approach to do this kind of scaling.
Hello. Hello. Does it work? Yeah. Hello, my name is Jean-Hugues Gavarini from Lake Company. So the water distribution system is broken. The proof, the biggest proof, is that 2.2 billion of people are suffering from water scarcity. We're talking of one quarter of the whole world. So it's a lot of people. So why Lake decided to use the blockchain, this fantastic tool, is because, as you just said, Stephanie, we have also 2 billion of people who are unbanked. They don't have bank accounts. They can't buy. They just can't open bank accounts. They have networks. They have money or something to exchange, but they don't have bank accounts, so they can't buy anything. So blockchain is open to those people, to those 2.2 billion of people. They can buy things and they can exchange things on the blockchain without having a bank account. So this is a very good tool. Blockchain is also very good for, as I can say, transparency and traceability. In our case, as instance, the people who will be in our ecosystem will be able to donate water to those who don't have the chance to have any. And so to make sure those people, their money goes directly to those who need water, well, it's very essential that we have traceability and transparency. And blockchain is the most modern tool in our days for that. So it gives us really an opportunity to change and disrupt this world where water is a huge problem. And also, blockchain is very good because you can create a huge community that believes in your ambition, your ideas. So people follow us, follow what we want to do, how we want to disrupt and change the world. And so people just can follow us through the blockchain. And so it really helps us to build a big community and also to finance, because to bring water to those who don't have any, it costs a lot of money. It's a huge challenge. And I don't know any other tools today that can make people communicate all together to build something new. And so that's why blockchain is very interesting for us.
Hello. This is Hori from EthiHub. As I see, is for sure a tool for improving human coordination, as some of you talk. For sure, it is more traceable. You can automate things, so efficiency can be improved. But for me, the key point of crypto is tokenomics, no? Is creating incentive loops. So crypto incentives, I think, is a tool to scale to change behaviors, no? To embed a theory of games within the value chain, within the value proposal of your project, and so incentivize that people act in the way that is required for the project to be successful. No? And I think that's the most important and potential and also abstract and hard to do part of leveraging on this technology. And also, for sure, in the long term, like decentralized governance. No? I think that's like the end goal, that we really scale how we interact as human beings. First, we had governments, then we had companies, and now we envision this idea of DAOs as a new economic actor in the economy. And I think in 100 years, it will be the biggest economic actor, but we are just understanding how to do that.
Hi, so I'm Quentin from Honest. One of the questions I've been asking myself, and sometimes I ask people too, since 2014, 10 years, it's why blockchain? Like, why do you really need blockchain? And blockchain is something that has been, especially like in the food industry and that kind of thing, that people thought like it's blockchain for good marketing. What was interesting for them is the marketing, not are we tracking things better? Because what is blockchain? And blockchain is a peer-to-peer network to be able to exchange value. So what's important is exchanging value. You can exchange, like we said, tokens. You can exchange cryptocurrency. Or we can exchange other type of values, like ownership. And if you just use blockchain as a database, so you take events, and you put these events in a blockchain and say, okay, no, it's great traceability, and everything is like, look, it's open, and people can look at it and say yes, but is it like the same events as before, and it's the same errors as before, so you didn't change a thing by doing this. So that's why when we like thought about what is blockchain in the term of ownership, we thought about using it to transfer ownership. And ownership is like a two-sided coin. It's not just, like I said, like to say, like this phone, so I own this phone. So I'm the owner of this phone. But at the same time, I'm also responsible for it. If I broke it, then I need to buy a new one, for example. And if I give it to someone else and say, you are now the responsible for it, then it will have to pay for it. So if you can transfer ownership and responsibility in the logistics, in the flows, you can know at any point in time who is responsible, who is the owner of something. And you can do this while tokenizing something. So for example, we could think about like a flat. So you can have one person owning a flat and living inside that flat too. Or you could have someone owning it and someone else renting that flat. So you have one owner and one responsible. Or you could have, like, in France, we have an SCI and, like, multiple people owning that flat and multiple people being responsible one after the other of that flat. So this is, like, what we see. Like, our protocol of ownership is this. It's something that is quite complex. That is not just, like, you see that just the owner on one side or just the responsible on the other side. You manage both aspects at any point in time. And by doing this, you can really track what's happening and know what's happening, which isn't always the best idea for some big corporations who don't really want to do that. So it's also a question, do corporation really want people to know what's happening or not?
I'd like to add, it's working?
I think so.
Yeah, okay. I think one of the biggest problems of the global system is they are not designed for small scale. And most of the world, I mean, a quarter of the world population is small scale. And they are unbanked, and they are not connected. And we have to reach them and include them. But if we want to include them through digital means that they don't have, they will remain excluded. So going back, why blockchain? Because it enables a disintermediation that nowadays is the only way to reach these tiny people, these tiny communities. It's only through so many intermediaries that extract value from the value chain because they are just keep gators, not providers of value into this. So in order to solve this dysfunction, we need to disintermediate. And I think blockchain is the proper tool to enable this disintermediation, but also to enable the incentives to people make it work. Because nowadays, we're proving in EthiHub that these unbanked farmers are benefit from the blockchain even if they don't directly interact with it because they don't have connectivity. So I think the challenge is to think from the very beginning when we design a global system to be inclusive. You cannot say we have a developed economic model when one out of every four human beings has not access to it. And they are producing, from these four, most of them are small farmers. We're talking about one-fifth of the world population producing one-third of the world food and living in poverty. Because the current system is working, the fintech evidently want to tap this market because it's huge. It's almost $1 trillion annually. But they use, again, the same mistake. In Spain, they say the fish that bites his tail. Like, we need data to reach them, but they don't have data. So we need data to reach them, but they still don't have data. So if you base your solutions in data and in assets, and they have tiny assets, and they don't have data, we have to rethink everything. So when we think inclusion, think who are we letting out? Because when we are talking here from the European perspective, we don't see that being poor is not just not having money to pay for internet. It's just internet not being available kilometers around yourself. It's not just a willing thing, but a systemic thing that we can contribute. And I think blockchain is the tool, as I said at the beginning, not just because of the coordination, not just because it can enable electricity to them. By the way, the unbanked farmers are the same number than the people without electrical services because it's the same people. Those scatterings around the mountains producing part of our food. So let's give a voice to the invisible, please, and consider them every time. I'm Gabriela Chang from EthiHub, and I'm always trying to talk about to talk on behalf of those who don't have a voice and are not able to be here because they cannot take a plane, because they don't have a passport, because they don't have an identity to cross our borders. Thank you.
So I may start with the first question. So what do you think that you know, where would you start? What would it look like as a project that works for that? And is it linked to another way of building incentive?
First is to eat and to be Christian, they say. First is the financial thing, because that's the basic, the very basic. When you need to get in debt to buy the medicines for your daughter, I mean, you need to build a healthy baseline to start projecting for the future. So I think blockchain initial promise was to enable a financial system where no one was left behind. And we don't have to wait until they have wallets to be included. So I think we start by that. We start by revising our supply chains, because I say that and I will repeat it. Every time those of us here who are privileged enough as to eat 3 times a day, every time we buy something for a house, we're changing the world, we're changing the economy. This is in our hands, beyond technology. So get responsible of what we consume. Who do we buy it from? It doesn't matter if it's financed through blockchain as we do or to fiat. Just take conscious of who are you buying your stuff from, because you're moving the world, the economy with this. So I think the first starting point would be self-conscious about consume, responsible consume, and relate that the main real world assets are healthy food, clean air, fresh water, and let's give value to that.
Is it, yeah, if there are any questions, but is it a question of incent?
If I stand up, you can see me. My name is Gert-Jan Storm. I work with a Brussels-based NGO, European Partners for the Environment, and we have had the opportunity to work with Blockchain for Good at the preparatory phase to launch bc100plus.org, where we endeavor to connect to what happens in the digital world. I advise on what EPE is doing, and I have been, I have had the opportunity to engage with the European Biodiversity Partnership, which is a 7-year program of the European Union, where the issues you mentioned, food, energy, water, are core. And at the risk of being long, I try to be short, but bear with me. I have a few proposals. The one is to see what this partnership, which is driven by public European research institutes since 2005, and now includes South Africa, Brazil, and a number of countries in Africa as partners, how to address what you are aiming to address simultaneously and in a coherent way. And there are some hard nuts to crack when it is about data, because when I have talked about digital in the multi-stakeholder setup this platform has with the same group of actors as you mentioned in the beginning, academia, civil society, like the Nature Conservancy and the World Conservation Monitoring Center of the UN, they will say, well, biodiversity is very much about living organisms, and what you see today is not the same tomorrow. It's like your kid growing up, and 5 years later, it's a totally different person. So it's hard to work with data. We tend to look at the policy level in the EU. What about precaution, a precautionary approach to policy making to bring about transformative change in the European food system, which has an enormous negative impact both on European citizens and on via their externalities in the supply chains. So I'll stop here just to mention that example, but if there's one thing the European Union has failed to deliver, is to have a healthy and affordable food for European citizens. When you look at the evolution of obesity or of neurodegenerative diseases caused by pesticides over the past 50 years, it's devastating, and the bill to society and to citizens is even worse, because it's about hundreds of billions of euros per year. So I think it would be nice to seek for ways to team up and to reach out to my biodiversity society and try to find bridges with what you are doing, especially with regard to our stop food systems and the textiles value chain, because they stick together.
Yeah.
When you look at the analysis of the Biomimicry Institute, the nature of fashion. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's all linked. So the question being about system. Yeah,
Related to that, for sure, we are not perfect in Europe, but we are far behind the States, for example, no, and many other economic regions, because, for example, here the glyphosate is forbidden. In other regions, it's still allowed, and we have the regulation for no deforestation that it affects us in Ethihub. And I think that's a very Europe is pushing with this regulation a change in the value chain, because the actual value chain, as we were talking before, is super intermediated. It's super long. So Nestlé don't know who produces his coffee. It is hundreds of intermediaries in between. So they cannot know if it is deforestation behind their coffee. So European regulation is forcing to provide traceability to change the value chain. And I think that that's a huge opportunity for us, no, that we are trying to work with blockchain, with the small holder farmers to provide electricity or water or financing or communication, because we are the ones that can produce that data within the value chain, no? and I think we should be bullish, no? And this is one of the key parts that we have to bring capital to make the change we want to see in the world, and we have to embrace these changes as an opportunity, no? to drive capital to our missions.
There's a question behind you, Stephanie.
Well, if you wanted to bounce back on this, go ahead.
No, it's just that I think I wasn't precise enough about the traceability when I talked before, and I was just thinking about, because I listened to you, and I let you speak after, sorry about that. It's just when I said, in our example, when people make donation, a lot of times they don't know where their money is going. I take as an example Melinda Gates Foundation, which is huge. We're talking about a few billions of dollars given to this foundation. Well, we don't know where the money goes, and we don't know if it goes to the really end where the people need it. So in our case, that's why the blockchain is very interesting, because the traceability can prove the donator where exactly his money is going. And that's what I just wanted to add. It's really, that traceability thing is really important. And as you say, it's a good opportunity for us to develop. And so sorry about that.
No, it's actually a great transition to my question. So hi, my name is Pierre. I'm part of the Scientific Council of Blockchain for Good. And I will introduce myself later as I introduce the next panel. My question is, what we are talking about today, and especially right now, it sounds all a bit familiar when you consider like Max Avila and all of the fair trade movement and all of those, this label approach of making sure that your consumption choices are consistent with your values, is actually going fairly remunerating the people who produce on the ground. So what's blockchain, like, how is this really changing the game? And is it just about having a decentralized ledger that gives more transparency? Really, my question is, how at each of you in your individual projects, how are you really changing the relationship also between the end users or the investors and the people on the ground that are in charge of either stewarding ecosystems, farming, producing food or energy?
Thank you. I had a very steep learning curve because as an engineer, I came in and said blockchain, DLTs, smart contracts, automate everything, and everything that is human. And what changed my insights and also the whole worldview actually is to understand it's about transparency, yes, but now that we can actually have incentive programming opportunity, which is policy making, but that opportunity is now open to everyone who can code, but that might improve. But one thing it opened up is it's a rabbit hole of insights into what is incentives, what is motivating me. Right now, tokenization or what we think about is creating financial incentives and motivating people to do things for a little bit more money. And in the energy or decentralized energy, this is the simplest layer that you can get. Yes, it's about decentralizing finance that, you know, DAOs that stand for a decentralized organization of participants can now own a decentralized pool of solar roofs that are on commercial and industrial buildings that have their own value chains, part of a supply chain, so you are decarbonizing the economy and you can be part of it. We tried many ways to have this permissionless participation and it didn't work out because it requires a lot of mental capacity that we don't have free. People need to go to work, and make their business work, and so on and so forth. And we're coming here with programming incentives and so on. So that really is the core that people need to understand and see it as an opportunity. It's about participation. It's about learning what we value. And it's about the possibility to embed this value into every value chain. That means creation of value, deciding on how to share the value, capture it, that's possible through tokenization, and how to share the value. That brings us to the point of governance. So 100 years, I agree. but what are the baby steps we can do from here? And I believe it starts with, yes, financial value, we can transact it over the internet now, fine, but what value can we add? Let's start with the ones that are quantifiable, like the environmental value of solar. It is quantifiable, we don't need to have a discussion, deliberation on that. It's not the same as social values, but those are the values that keep our civilization livable, right? And those are the values, if no one stands up for them, if no one recognizes them, if they remain invisible and forgotten, we will be very, very poor. And maybe a society, global, not able to live. So 100 years, that's the goal, but we're starting already.
I'd like to add to that, that we have to, as you were saying, what are you doing? How are we doing it now? I don't expect humanity to evolve because they are good-hearted, because we would change many centuries ago. So, departing from the point where humanity is now, we have to use these incentives. Now, you earn 8% annual return for investing into the farmers. You benefit from solving problems. You are not seeing this as solving problems. You are investing, and you are getting a benefit. So, we are building an infrastructure that allows share value generation, and you are not doing it out of philanthropy, because philanthropy is a part for the huge problem. The problem is systemic, so we cannot solve it with small mending. We need a structural thing. And this structural thing goes by generating benefits also for you because you are solving the problem, even if you see this as an investment. So I think the rewards, the emotional rewards are valuable. And if we go beyond, deeper into the blockchain possibilities, is not a new front end to make, as we were saying yesterday, Wall Street on steroids, doing the same that we have, repeating the same problems with traceability and transparency and faster for the same people. No, we have the opportunity to have a new back end to represent other forms of value, to include the cost of externalities into what we build. If we have the example I did yesterday, a cheap pair of shoes, you're paying with your taxes to clean the rivers that were polluted by building those cheap shoes. So this is like the possibility. But the real thing that we are doing now is investing into something that is profitable for you and profitable for the farmers and profitable for Etihad also. Solving problems should be profitable, should be incentivized, because common good cannot be lent in the hands of governments only or in the hands of non-for-profit, because you can do voluntary work for 1 or 2 years, but how do we bring the brightest mind to solve the biggest problems? You expect this to be for free. There is enough value to be shared as long as we rethink the supply chains we are having nowadays.
Is that possible? It was about like the Max Havelaar idea, you know? And I think one thing that wasn't really mentioned a lot, and that blockchain changed, is identity. Like, we can know, like, everyone can know an identity, like, it's a decentralized and available for everyone identity. And that's something that is different from what we have now, where we say, look, that's a small farmer from somewhere. Okay, but I have no direct contact. I don't really know if it's the real farmer or just a marketing thing that was generated with ChatGPT. So you can know this, and you can have something that is trustless when you have the transfers of something from ownership or something else. It can be done with an open source, open blockchain, where the big corporate is not here to like wipe out if something have gone bad. Like, if it was accepted, it's accepted and it's not in the blockchain and you can't change a thing. So I think that's the big difference between the current system, which is still like centralized and mostly managed by the big corporate who choose what they want to show, and the future blockchain where it's decentralized identity and ownership management like this.
So there's a certain base level at which people are talking about, which doesn't inquire into this word that you said, value, and Sebnem was hinting at this, that the things that are priceless can't have a value attached to them. As soon as you do that, you break them. So my son doesn't have to pay me back for breastfeeding. And there is no price for the fact that we've taken people away from their grandmothers in order to go work in the city. There's no price. So this idea that we're going to somehow price the externalities, like, there's no... like, if you drive by a mountain that's been chopped to pieces, there's no appropriate price for that. And the only price that you could put on it would be something that people think because it hurt my lungs or what, you know, like... value is not represented by money, and money is a very antiquated technology that we needed to use before we had digital technologies that we have that have the power that we have today. So, for example, like, money doesn't exist. It's not a thing like, oh, I'm going to get profit in my pocket. Like, we're about to see the absolute, like, destruction of financial systems. Those of you who aren't in Venezuela who have already seen it, right? Money just disappears overnight because it doesn't exist. But our topsoil doesn't disappear. Like, our topsoil disappears because we kill it. And that, like, so you have to start to differentiate. And we have this whole, like, evolution of money happened because if you had eggs and you had coal and we wanted to trade and blah, 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 we couldn't keep track. We can now. We can now. We don't need money as a proxy anymore. If we want to measure water quality, we can measure water quality. If we want to do very complex interactions among us, we can track them. And that's where blockchain comes in, not to use this weird proxy that is completely meaningless. And I love that we can print money out of thin air. Like, don't get me wrong, okay? I've been surviving the last few years on it. I love the money printed out of thin air thing. It's great. But we need to move beyond that, and we have the opportunity because we have blockchain, and we can make measurements and reliable measurements and verifiable measurements of the things we care about, because it's not money. And if, as long as you're thinking, oh, I've got to be profitable, and I'm a dog, and I'm going to get incentive doggy biscuits, it's like, I don't want to live like that.
I want to synthesize what Pierre started and comes around through you, Grace. Maybe we don't need to price it, because price is just a signal for everyone to decide what we are orienting. So what if now that we can make our actions immutably recorded on the blockchain transparently, and we talk about values and we know we have them, what if we don't have to price them, but we just make the delta visible? What is my value action gap? What is the community's here collected collective value action gap? And how can we, through which actions that will be recorded for us and everyone to see, how can we minimize that value action gap? And that's the thing. So it's basically helping us to change our behavior in a way that isn't dictated top down or by CEOs and policies, but by us all. So that's definitely a possibility. And the fun thing about token economy is it's a system that has been used in mental health to change behavior just by showing what am I doing, what do I want to do, and how can I close this gap. So I think it's a really good insight, so thank you for providing that.
So I think that there's one set of conversations here about the sort of ideological aspects of these technologies, and you know, so that's a really important and powerful set of conversations. But there's also the other conversations, which are really about the systems and the upgrades to the systems that this provides. And this has a very, very powerful potential. So I'll just give you an example of one of the things we're working on, which is transitioning the 2.3 billion people who still cook on with traditional fuels and so on, which causes emissions on the scale of the airline industry. Now, there's really good technologies. They're quite cheap to get highly efficient, clean-burning cook stoves that don't pollute. But actually getting those cook stoves out to people, ensuring that they get to the right people, measuring the usage of the cook stoves, enabling carbon finance through carbon credits to finance those cook stoves, and then distributing the value that gets generated back to the households that are using the cook stoves and the youth I mentioned earlier who are helping to distribute and support, provide technical support to the households and so on. All of this can now be done with a huge systems upgrade in a way that we're doing it real time. And the legacy system, you know, you implement a project, you get project finance, which is already a level of abstraction. It takes many months, if not years, to actually get the project finance in place. You roll out the cook stoves, then you start a crediting program. Many months, probably 2 years later, you get the carbon credits. There's the whole problem with the carbon credits market, which will be discussed this afternoon. And then the money comes, you know, sort of, you know, way down the line, too late to benefit the person who cooked today. With the systems upgrade, we've got real-time data. I can show you on the application right now. I can show you at an individual cook stove level, the usage of that cook stove, the fuel that was purchased, and the real-time carbon credit generation, which creates a much greater velocity of capital, so to enable the scaling, but also in a format with digital currency that is so much easier and programmable and cheap and so on to distribute across the supply chain. And so I think the sort of bringing this conversation back to the topic of this part of the unconference about supply chains, it's really about kind of looking at a supply chain, the value chain, who creates value in the value chain that is linked to the supply chain, and then how do we upgrade that with digital technologies in a way that that it's not value captured by central by intermediaries and central owners of the system.
I think it is a huge opportunity here, because if you think of the global economy, most of it has been already digitalized. Commerce, no, in the cities, everything is already digitalized. But in the food supply chains, it's one of the very few sectors in the world that haven't been yet disrupted by new actors, because it's much harder, no? And with this upgrade in technology, we have the opportunity to do so.
It's not harder. It's just that it's very centralized at the moment. Oh, sorry.
You want to directly? Yeah, then go.
Thanks. Well, just to top up. Again, like my name is Sunil. I work with the blind people, the most marginalized, who have no idea of what we're speaking here. So, just to go on to Sean's point, are we really pushing for a blockchain solution when there are other alternatives, like what Gabriela said, being more conscious about things, what you said about being more empathetic? Are we really pushing for? So, just to take out on what you said, do we need a cooking stove? We could just go for solar stoves and forget the carbon credits. The alternatives may be out there, while we are trying to catch our nose from the other side, while not look at options where, split it up, the supply chains that require a cooking stove for the millions, I'm just taking an example, while they can go through carbon credits, blockchain, value, etc. But otherwise, just look at alternatives like solar stoves or alternatives that are green. Because today, our focus is to get it on the chain, to get it so-called carbonized or valued, will take much more time if we were to look at this than ready-made solutions where, I think next session talks about it, where the need of the hour is to become clean and green.
But who pays for that? I mean, it's great. There are many different technological solutions. It may be solar, it may be maybe biomass fuel or whatever, but somebody's got to pay for the infrastructure. And that's the problem, is that actually scaling the financing and linking it to the opportunity, actually. I mean, we're talking a lot about kind of what's broken and what needs to be fixed and so on. But there is actually great opportunity right now. There is these implementations of Article 6.2 of the Paris Agreement. We're already starting to see the money flows between countries on corresponding adjustments and ITMOs and so on. So that was internationally transferred mitigation outcome. So I was asked not to use acronyms. And so there is real money and there's real opportunity. It takes a really long time to get these things in place. And what I'm finding, having worked previously in my previous life in the development sector for UN agencies and governments and so on, and then over the last 10 years working in Web3, is that we're at a point right now where the people I've been having conversations with, trying to convince the institutions, the banks and so on, are really at a point where they're going, okay, I think this is actually a solution, because we can't really do it without these technologies. And then, of course, we've also got this massive pull factor with AI, and you know, so people are going, okay, well, you know, like data is really important. You get a lot of utility out of the data, and the world is changing, and what's going to happen to jobs and so on. So I think we've really at a very, very important inflection point, and that it's really important for us not to continue kind of philosophizing about it, but actually just to really do things that will implement and make a change.
May I? Yeah, sorry. I hear, hi, I'm Anne. I'm both teaching and also doing research at the university over there in Germany. I hear several topics here where blockchain technologies can help. For instance, you just mentioned that, like, okay, there's money. It can actually, a tool to put in money to actually change. It can also be used to incentivize behavioral changes. It can be the data that can be tracked and traced through blockchain or, among others, blockchain technologies to know actually what we're doing in real time and then accordingly change. And then it can also help with agency by allowing ownership and responsibility. So these are the different topics I hear. What I'm interested in is like the underlying notions you have. I hear also a narrative of the that's my interpretation, a narrative of an idea of the human being able, you can change behavior or change perhaps thinking through incentives. And I hear a lot of an economic view that human beings are first and foremost interested in money. So I'm not sure if I hear that right. I hear someone shaking the head, so that's kind of like good to hear. So I'm wondering about the notion, how much can money actually do, if it's digitalized or not? And then I'm also wondering what kind of incentives, to whom? Whom would you like to kind of like gives incentives to, because you want to change the system, right? So who are the actual leverage points in that system? Overall, what I'd like to actually ask is, in an ideal future, a desirable future, how would you imagine blockchain technology's role in that? Like, where, what kind of function does it have? Where does it help with processes, mechanisms, infrastructure within a whole new system? And also the role of human beings. I would love to hear your ideal imagination of potential futures where blockchain actually has an enabling role. That was long, sorry.
May I just take your part off the table? So when we talk about incentives, incentive mechanism, design mechanism is very engineering heavy, and there is a discipline which is a transdisciplinary discipline called token engineering, and we take up the crypto economics. Now, crypto economics started very simple. One petal here, cryptography, and the other petal here, economics. But in token engineering, we analyzed that it's about resource allocation and how to make decisions about resource allocation, and second-order cybernetics, who decides. So, and then this foundations of crypto economics looks at all the disciplines. I'm saying because you said you're from the university. So it's very important that to understand that people in this space really are looking in the cross-pollination across all of the petals of this crypto economics flower, which is on one hand AI optimization, operations research, everything technical, data-driven, but on the other side also everything humanities, ethics, legal science, and so on and so forth, political economy. So it's, again, also it's about value that we know we do not want to print it into one dimension, because that produces linear solutions, which we already have, but currently that's happening. We are, or not we, but the larger space is porting the linear financial solutions onto crypto, and then it becomes financial convoluted instruments on steroids. But this time it's going to be recorded on the ledger, how these things fly out of proportion and then can be analyzed, and we can become wiser, and we might change our behavior because we have data that shows how these simple financial instruments are wreaking havoc. So again, it's way more, much more, but unfortunately we're seeing always the tip of the iceberg, which is just financialization of everything, commodification of everything, and then make everything be transacted on chain. But it's just, you know, there is the iceberg itself, and it's really deep, so I hope you join the token engineering community as a researcher.
Yeah, and you said, when you put together incentivizing behaviors, and I'm thinking, why talking just about economics? Because today's panel is about supply chain, so we're focusing on that, but evidently there are higher values than just the economic ones. But we need to focus on that now, even if more things kind of spread out of it.
Going forward, no, to your question of the future, no, it is, we are, I mean, there is also this question for sure if we are homo economicus or not, but for now, we have grown within this world in which money is important, and for sure, I totally agree that that's a cancer, that we are so focused on money, and there are tons of other forms of value, and maybe we have to tokenize them, maybe not. There is a lot of questioning about that. But the point I want to bring is, okay, first, the capital markets, as we know them, the financial markets, etc., with based on money and tokenized assets, etc., that works well for companies, no, for people in the cities, etc. And I think there blockchain is like super cool. But when you go down to reaching these people excluded from the global economy nowadays, in the base of this of the supply chain, maybe we should think better on post-blockchain solutions like Holochain, no, or EXA, or things like that, that at the end is more distributed, transferring value, mutual credit systems. There is a lot of alternatives that also distributed technologies allow, no, to scale human collaboration. And I think the one of the key points is, okay, we have to empower both ways. One is it's already happening within blockchain, but the other one, there are some projects doing some amazing job, like Will Rudick in Kenya with grassroots economics, etc. The key point is to make a bridge between improving the financial markets and creating these new alternatives from the ground up, and create the bridge between these two systems, because at the end we need both to collaborate, to be connected, not like today that they are excluded.
So I think this is about how we will be able to meet our fundamental human needs. So it's not really Maslow sort of hierarchy, but we've got all fundamental needs. We all have a need for sustenance, you know food and water and so on, a need for protection, a need for identity, a need for love and affection, a need for recreation. It's about 9 needs, which are kind of fundamental across cultures and across history. How these needs get met is by what we have, what we do, and what we're connected to. And what we have and what we do and what we're connected to, it very much depends on the interfaces that we have in the world. We're talking supply chain again. So if I go into a supermarket next to the railway station, I have some money, and what I can do is I can choose between one or another food that has a very complex supply chain behind it, but I don't really have much choice. And my interface with that is I'm interfacing with a complex system with a need, and that need is only met in one sort of dimension. Compare that to being able to go to a farmer's market and you have a much greater joy and experience of life because of all the reasons why it's great to go to a farmer's market. And so what these technologies offer the potential for is that the choices that we will have will be more. I mean, we're already seeing that you can have a lot more choice in like which cryptocurrencies you hold in your wallet. That our ability to exercise those choices in terms of rights should improve. I mean, this is a huge narrative. It's really about fundamentally how you exercise your rights across all different domains of rights. And the participation mechanisms, you know. So do I just have to be a consumer, or could actually be part of the supply chain and part of the information economy So I do think that bringing all these things together in a way that they work for us, but they're abstracted away, so we don't have to go and deploy a smart contract in order to get our job done, but rather the interfaces will be like natural language interfaces, our own personal agents, AI agents, you know, where you can talk to your agent and say, well, you know, which of these things is probably better for me? And your agent will know your preferences and so on. So that's the kind of future world I think that we're headed into. But for that to really happen in a non-dystopian way, it has to be decentralized, and we have to get out of the stranglehold of large companies that are built to extract value rather than contribute value to the system and the economy.
I'm also thinking about how to go about the subject matter. I'm not yet on board with the blockchain community. Let me just advance a few themes. When I talk about systems change in food systems, the common agricultural policy, it is time to listen to citizens, to human beings, we all are in Europe, and turn around the system. That's not the only reason. By investing in sustainability in food systems and textiles value chain, one addresses a very substantial part of the global agenda of climate change, biodiversity, water, etc. It's close to 50%. So in that respect, it's a huge step to be taken, which has not been done so far. But when you look at the risks as they have been analyzed, a safer operating space for humanity, planetary boundaries, planetary commons, the risks are much higher than they were. So that's kind of a must to ensure a prospect of future prosperity for European citizens to invest as soon as possible in the transformation of food systems, which is supported by IPCC, IPBES, which has, as a matter of fact, a very interesting analysis of the issue of value, not only in monetary terms, but also in the terms of nature, dating back from July 2022. And to finish off with, it's about very practical steps where citizens can play a role to contribute, reducing food losses and waste. The same for textiles, and buy textiles that are based on natural fibers and don't buy synthetic fibers anymore. And a shift to ecological practices in the EU and local supply chains, which is much closer to, let's say, going local. Decentralization goes hand in hand. And by doing so, we create much better opportunities for countries in Africa to be freed from the impact of overconsumption in the EU by finally mitigating climate change.
Thank you. And I'm wondering if there are any examples from, you know, Edigherb or Honest on that could be, we didn't necessarily think about the textile, but any example of ways of working that actually could answer this topic. We haven't necessarily covered the ecological impact of our production and our supply chain, but maybe there's something here to kind of bounce off in terms of concrete example that could apply.
In order to arrive to those smallholder farmers, I think it's key to have a holistic view, no? An integrated solution. So our approach to it is we integrate financing and trade, because then you have an improved business model with better unit economics that allow you to arrive where only financial solution cannot arrive, neither only commercialization solution. And for sure, we have to implement two carbon credits and solar panels and coke stoves. And I think we all have to collaborate to be able to bring together value to those excluded in a sustainable, profitable way that can be scaled.
So you had asked for examples, and also like this global and scaled and all this stuff is not how it's going to go. And as this gentleman pointed out, these long supply chains are not going to survive much longer. The prices of energy are much higher than they used to be, not just in dollars, but in calorie in versus calorie out. A barrel of oil today takes a lot more calories to get out of the ground than it used to. And solar panels, even lower calorie per calorie input and output. And the supply chains are going to break. And it's not just because the Gulf is closed and et cetera. So as far as real life examples, and non-scalable examples and how local things get all of a sudden. We've got the EcoVillage network within Europe and throughout the world, and they're really struggling because when they grow their food locally and ecologically, and when they do things like take down the huge range of pine trees that have been put all over Europe because they're easier to harvest and try to regenerate with more indigenous and more varied species, that costs them a lot of money. They don't get paid for restoring the earth and the topsoil. Quite the opposite. They do a lot of that by volunteer. And the example that was really striking 2 years ago was at the EcoVillage gathering. It was in Denmark, and the Danish had put in somewhere around €1 million into the Ukrainian EcoVillage network because the entire system in Ukraine collapsed except for the EcoVillages. And the EcoVillages, because they had an alternative supply chain and an alternative economic system, they were able to save only a few thousand people and bring a few thousand people into their network. I really hope that statistically we're going to move beyond that, because that type of collapse is coming in many different places due to ecological damage, due to warfare and the social unrest that we're seeing anywhere, everywhere. And if you think about, okay, how many people we lost in Ukraine, and it's not done yet, a third of the land in the Ukraine was sold to economic interests, mostly American interests. Wow, that's a really big surprise given who's funding that war. We're losing our agricultural land, and there are physical wars killing people over it. And I think there's a lot of hope in these small on-the-ground systems and their ability to connect with one another and their ability to have local supply chains. Hemp can be grown. Wool can be grown. Let's not grow cotton in Europe. It's too water intensive. But we have to create alternative networks. I don't agree that we need to tie into the existing networks, because those things are coming. And wherever we tie into the existing networks, they eat us up and kill us off. Maybe it's an extreme view, but that's what I'm seeing.
So I'm originally from Kyrgyzstan. And in Kyrgyzstan, we're famous for felt, production of felt and carpets and hats you may have seen. So at some point, I remember maybe 10 years ago, there was suddenly an interest abroad in seeing these felt products exported. So there was a lot of emphasis on fair trade and making sure that there is a connection to the community and all of that. But actually now, when I see some of these felt products in Europe, I actually have very mixed feeling about seeing them in Europe because there was so much emphasis on fair trade that actually resulted, that's why I work on decolonization, in extraction of value and culture from the community, right, in exchange for money. And so we are kind of closing the same situation as, you know, for example, 95% of African art is outside of Africa. So by focusing so much on kind of the production and fair trade, we're actually extracting the value from the community. And so I'm thinking about how do we actually revert it and make sure that we create more value for the community to keep things in the community, and we grow value, you know, inside and not outside kind of production. And this is why where you mentioned, you know, kind of how do we think of value more broader. And I think this is where we are at a point where we need to think of the value beyond kind of the monetary terms, but the community value. Personally, like, I work on these things. For me, the biggest challenge, and it's like an elephant in the room, is where does the money come from to pilot some of the solutions and implement some of the solutions? And the truth is that most of the money comes from the private sector or like venture capital. Venture capital is not interested in doing anything that is about value for the community. They're interested in like, what is my return on investments? Then we go for the development actors, and development actors are, well, Web3, blockchain, too risky, and, you know, kind of we're not adapting those solutions. And as a result, you know, if we are really thinking about transformative systemic change that is going to challenge the status quo, we don't have the right alignment of actors who could actually implement these solutions. We have either like a commercial approach or sort of a development aid that is not yet ready. And this is where we're stuck. Like, personally, for me, I work on democratizing funding for social impact and decolonizing aid. And the challenge is in like aligning actors and finding the right investments that is not gonna look for like return on investments that is gonna push us in the corner, you know, to deliver on some of this. Anyway, I just thought that we need to also consider about how we build partnerships to achieve kind of the value that we want to see.
I have an idea for you. And it's funny because I've been doing in this same city 25 years ago a conference about fair trade, you know, and the fact that the value is captured actually into the branding and not into the commodity, which means that the most important value was coming to a company from the West, to make it short. But what about bottom-up data? What about decentralized MRV? Suddenly, for me, it's the future of fair trade. It's a possibility. I mean, I don't know what people from Ethicab are saying. It's a possibility for the small company or the small farmer to value and get the money for it, the fact, and keep most of the value of what they produce at their level and not within all the intermediaries. For me, it's clear, you know, fair trade is 21st century is bottom-up data. And if anyone wants to comment on that, I'm curious.
Yeah, I would like to comment on fair trade. I talked some years ago with the global president of it, and we were talking about smallholder farmers. And I was talking about farmers with 2 hectares, which is the average of the people producing most of the coffee in the world. And she said, "We are very sorry, but we are not able to reach them yet, because it's too expensive, you know, to go there." And I say, this is 80% of the coffee in the world, and you cannot reach them because of the system. So I agree with you. This is more a marketing thing to say that you are doing fair trade, but the fair price doesn't go to the farmer. So by disintermediating, what we become is partners of these small farmers. We sell their coffee. They receive the money for the coffee they deliver, so they don't risk. And that's a fair price, locally. But after the people finance the exporting, the processing and exporting, and maybe 7-8 months later, we sell the coffee to a roaster, part of the price, almost 50% of the margin, goes back to the farmer. So this incentivizes quality because the farmer still has not sold the coffee until the final buyer tastes it. So we do a quality control at the beginning, of course. We know it's going to be an additional price. But he's incentivized to do so because he gets paid for doing so. And regarding the certification system, it's also the small farmers are excluded because, again, of the size. And when I talk about the problem of scale, I don't mean to do a global scale. I mean the global system to consider the tiny scales and to do a distributed little groups of this to coordinate globally, but not to build a global network to connect and to centralize again. I think centralization is at the core of our problems. We saw this with the COVID, when you have one channel cut and then all the supplies get stuck there. So I always do this example of Germany as a distributed country. Historically, they didn't have one king centralizing the power. So they have different principeships, I don't know how they call them. So they grow with the wealth quite distributed. So what about if one company, why one company should provide all the coffee in the world, or one producer in Peru should supply the whole Europe and Asia, extracting the water from a country? So we need to rethink the systems to do this, and it also goes through certification. Most of the produce farmers don't have access to this. So let's question ourselves, what are we supporting when we are demanding products with a stamp? This is just a tiny slice of the cake.
So there goes my question. I mean, I've also experienced and question about your experience that it's very hard to gain consensus about that's worth or that's valuable, such that end consumers can give their negotiation power to the beginning of the supply chain, right? That's what I want to do, but I don't know how. And in the middle, there's all these confusion, like, I'm for decentralization. I'm for the diversity, but we need a more transparent and more structured approach, like it exists in open source, for example. I mean, the Ethereum chain, it's a decentralized computing system that is it has to work. So they have to agree on the code level. And they manage it in a decentralized manner, and they have this consensus mechanism that isn't just code, or it's not automated in AI and so on. So how can we take an example from them? And we are in this domain, so we should really look into, okay, how is Ethereum coordinating all of that code update and so on? And how can we make that for work for the distributed MRV? Because as long as we don't agree on that, as long as everyone, oh, you should talk to them, oh, they're doing the same thing, or you should talk to them. I'm like, yes, the thing is, let's agree on and execute on that. If it works for computers, it will work for a measuring verification system. So I guess maybe at least those of us who are in this decentralized crazy world, let's look more on what is working and then adopt it for us. And then the question was like, what do you see?
So I just want to say that I don't think that you have to replace the certification agencies that have got a lot of years of consensus and experience and domain expertise and everything. You just need to give them better tools. I mean, that's what we're doing. So you can turn a process that was very manual and took 12 months and very, very costly, so you have to be big enough to make it cost effective. You can turn that into an automated process, and it becomes marginal cost of zero almost.
What's the automated part you're talking about?
The digital measurement reporting and verification to issue the digital certificates. So we're doing that with the gold standard methodology for metered and measured modern energy cooking devices, which is it's a consensus standard. It was developed over many years, and we've put that all into a fully digital process that happens within minutes of submitting a claim.
I would like to picture you an example of what the challenges are in these areas we're talking. Last time in Paris, I talked with a scientist that was working in biodiversity measurement in New Zealand, a project, and she was very interested into what we were doing. And she said, we don't need internet for this. And it's amazing because they don't have internet in this area we're working in, the Sierra Madre in Mexico. So she said, you send me the coordinates and I will tell you. And she said, oh, Gabriela, this is weird. There's no biodiversity in your area. And I said, no, there is no register of biodiversity in my area. Chiapas is very well known to be one of the hot spots in the world. But again, is the fish biting his tail? There is no data to record the huge biodiversity, so when you get into a digital system to check, you will see there's nothing there.
That's why we replace the traditional systems.
Yes, that's why we need to.
Excellent, very interesting. 90 minutes is definitely too short. We have the time for a last question, and then we'll have the lunch.
Hi, I'm Mark from the project called the Wellbeing Protocol. So we see the problem as being discussed, I think, a few times. Capitalism has a couple of features or bugs, centralization and extraction, and that's fine in an infinite system, but we obviously don't live in an infinite system. We've hit the boundaries. So we were funded by the New Zealand government to work with indigenous communities and bring that together with Web3, DAO sort of type principles. So essentially, to answer the question, can you scale localism? Can you create sort of economic hyper-local groups who are doing good together and then scale by replication? So create millions of these hyper-local groups that can start to create this sort of network of nodes that start to challenge the existing system. So, and you start that by starting to refunnel money. There's lots of money around to support localism and disadvantaged groups and the environment, so you start to refunnel that money into hyperlocal groups who make their own decisions around where that money goes. So, if anybody wants to know more about that, I'm presenting tomorrow at the Regen Hub. So, thank you.
And his app is awesome. Go to his thing.
Any reaction to that? Any reaction?
I find very interesting this global localism That's a new word. I haven't heard it before, and I think it illustrates very well what we need. We need those local partners to understand the millions of uniqueness, because even within one country, I mean, go backwards, we cannot pretend. That would be too colonizing approach and the totally wrong approach to think that we can implement one global solution for the billions of realities, because India is not the same in the north than in the south. Mexico is not the same within the same state, depending if you're in the coast or in the mountains. So by partnering with this localism, by partnering with these local people, not local people, I mean local links in the supply chain that are in direct contact with the producers, we can reach those different realities with this filter, with this partner that we call originator, this local partner, who understands the ideology, the culture, the idiosyncrasy of those groups they are interacting with. And then we, as a platform, connect all the technical and financial protocol of it. But the social approach, the identifying the peculiarities of each one of them, this, what's the word, localism?
Yes,
that needs to be connected in a network
without
pretending one single solution is standardized for everybody.
So we see localism right down to that sort of Dunbar's number, 150 people, or you know, between 15 and 300 people, you know, people who actually know each other. If you can support them and if you can allow them to spend money together, make decisions together more effectively, and that's where DAO sort of techniques can really sort of feed into that. We potentially can create these micro DAO communities and scale that by replication.
So. In Ethic Hub, we call it circles of trust and theory of game on the blockchain.
So you
put together both things and you can reach everyone, I guess.
Yeah.
And I'd say it's very mimetic too. And it's very loud. I'm actually close with that. Thank you very much to all our guests, to all of our special guests. Thank you for that amazing conversation. And let's go have lunch. Thank you.